You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atia, and I'm in Galway, a legendary city in Western Ireland, in search of literature. Desmond Kenny, who along with several siblings runs the family bookstore here, is an expert in matching book and reader. He stocks the U.S. Library of Congress when it comes calling. But as the day fades, what book does Des reach for? Which one speaks to him above all others? Let's find out. So here we are in your family's bookshop, Kenny's Books, and you've celebrated the 70th anniversary of this shop, which was founded by your parents. You've had ample time to read, and you've come up with a book called Kenny's Choice, 101 Irish Books You Must Read. My question is, where's James Joyce?
Up the creek.
He didn't make your cut.
No, he didn't make my cut. And a lot of people have asked me about that. There were a number of reasons. The first reason is that Joyce doesn't need me. The second reason is I came to the conclusion that there is no generosity in Joyce. Joyce is a Mayfainer. He is me and me alone and nobody else. And he never extends, as most other writers in this book do, the hand of celebration out to others to come in and join him. So for that reason, I didn't pick Joyce.
You did pick a book, though, called The Last of the Name by Charles McGlinchey. And when I asked you to think about a piece of writing that's had a big impact on you, it's this book that you chose.
That's right, yeah. Your question was a curious one. Initially, I thought of a book like Treasure Island. I thought of poets like Seamus Heaney. I thought of playwrights like Beckett and his Waiting for Godot. And then one day I was walking down through the shop shelves and I saw a book and I said, that's it. That's the one. That's definitely it. And the book I selected was The Last of the Name. That book reached inside my Irish soul and my Irish heart in a way that no other book does.
The Last of the Name began as an oral history.
Absolutely. It's one of the extraordinary things about it. The book itself emanated from a series of conversations back in the early 1950s. The perpetrator of the book, for want of a better term, was an old man called Charles McGlinchey. He was a weaver by trade. And at that period of his life, he had reached into his 90s. He had no family. His siblings had died. He himself had never married. So there was nobody to follow him. And he suddenly realized that the traditions which were embodied in his family and the local memories that they had were to be lost when he passed away. And so he began to talk to a local school teacher whose name is Patrick Kavanagh, no relation to the famous poet. Kavanagh was a local principal and began to realize that what McGlinchey was giving him in these continuous meetings they had was something quite unique in many respects, and yet an integral part of what Ireland was, how Irish people lived, since the very beginning of the 18th century, and that therefore it was precious. And so he, every evening after a conversation, would go to one of the school copybooks that his pupils used and copied down, as far as he could remember, what McGlinchey had narrated to him.
After Charles McGlinchey's death in his 90s and Patrick Kavanagh's death, his son, Des Kavanagh, ended up with these documents, mm-hmm. and he spoke about them to this famous Irish poet, Seamus Heaney.
Yeah, who won a Nobel Prize in 96. Yeah.
Who suggested that somebody else would be the right man to edit them into book form.
Yeah.
And he passed them along to Brian Friel, another famous Irishman.
Yeah. So Brian Friel edited the book. From the moment it kind of reached the shelves, it took on a life of its own. It is coming from a man who has lived all of his life, with the exception of perhaps 4 weeks, in the one small, tiny townland called Clonmany in County Donegal. But from the reader's point of view, it is such an intimate experience that by page 5, you are chewing this guy's tobacco. And by page 10, you're spitting into the fire with him.
Speaking of which, I'd like to go to the text and have you read a passage.
Sure. Right. At night time, there was no light about the house, only what came from the fire. A woman or two used to sit to one side of the fire, cloving or carding or spinning with the light of the fire. The rest of the house would be in darkness. If anybody came into the house, someone also always turned a turf in the fire to see who it was. The men sat about the kitchen chatting and telling stories, or maybe singing sometimes. Some of the old people could keep the house going till bedtime. There was nothing else the men could do after nightfall.
So what does that evoke in you, Des? You chose this book.
That evokes in me, obviously there was no electricity, there was no light, there was no nothing, and that actually presented itself right up to, in some instances, the early 60s in Ireland, especially in the more remote rural areas. What he's talking about there is what's known as a ceilidh. The ceilidh was a form whereby everybody in the village always went to one house every night. It's where the news of the day was imparted. And if a stranger was in town or in the area, all the better, because that was the only way they got the news in from the outside. Everybody in this story at that time, or at least certainly 90% of them, would have been illiterate. So they depended on the oral passage of information to keep them going. And the fire is an extraordinary part of this. As long as there was a fire, the hearth and the fire was alight, there was a soul in the house. Once the fire left the house, life left the house. So the turning of the turf was an acknowledgement of a newcomer, as well as obviously to see who it was. In these houses, the doors were always open. There was no such thing as locks, didn't exist. And there was always what's known as a settle bed beside the fire, so that if any itinerant or tramp came along the way and went in for a night's sleep, they just literally walked in to the door and walked into the settle bed and fell asleep. It was an extraordinary community, but then you couldn't move without being seen.
You couldn't move without being seen,
even in the dark. The whole village knew what was happening. There was a great deal of, I think, trust and confidence, but that doesn't exist today. And there was a great deal of, it was a simple life, yet in its simplicity there was a great wisdom.
But throughout Irish history, obviously, there's been a great deal of turmoil within Irish communities, brother against brother, factions, as this book describes.
The factions were between the villages. Where brother against brother became real was during the Civil War, after Ireland won its independence, which lasted from, I think, 1921 to 22. And that then developed into a political enmity. But generally speaking, there was little or no animosity. There'd be natural animosities about land and et cetera, et cetera. But the stranger knocking on the door had a right to enter. And the stranger knocking on the door had a right to rest, if rest there was, or to food, if food there was. There wasn't always food. So what we're looking at here would have been a vignette of community life, which just didn't happen in Clonmany, it happened right throughout the country. And it was known as Caelian.
You were mentioning that most of the people in this house around the fire would be illiterate.
Yeah.
This book was an oral narration, an oral history.
Yeah.
You and your family have been running a bookshop, and there's a very interesting translation that takes place from words to words in print.
There is. One of the more frequent questions I am asked is, how is it that the Irish are such good storytellers? I don't know, but I would imagine that it is because there is a natural ability to tell stories that's innate within our culture, that has been going on for centuries. I think you will find it in the Native Americans. The Indian people will have it. I think you will find it in the Aborigines. I think you will find it in areas where there are cultures that have remained indigenous and have stayed away from the main paths of so-called civilization, and evolved their own deep culture in an oral tradition.
Charles McGlinchey himself had not very much schooling. There's a passage that sheds a little light on that. Could you read again from the book?
Yeah, okay. I shall do that. When I was growing up, people hadn't as easy a way of living on them as they have now. There was little word of schooling or things like that. We had to help with the work in the springtime and foot turf and go after sheep or help at the harvest according to the season. It was a common thing for youngsters of 6 and 7 years to be hired out as herds from May to holiday, 21st of November, and they never saw the inside of a school unless maybe an odd while of a winter. I spent only 2 or 3 winters at school myself. I picked up a bit of reading and was getting on to figuring a little bit, but I never got as far as a second book. The only ones to get any chance that time were the younger members of a family. During the summertime, we were hardly ever at school. We were kept home for herding mostly, keeping cows from breaking over the march into a neighbour's field, or trying to keep them grazing around the edge of a field that corn or potatoes were growing in. It was nice in the good weather. When it came on wet, though, you had to be out just the same.
That's a very vivid image to me of the daily routine of living off the land.
Absolutely. You've also got to remember that McGlinchey would have been born in the 1860s. And there would have been very, very few schools around. And it would have been a kind of a primitive schooling. That is why the local schoolmaster and the priest were possibly the two most important people in the village, because they were the only ones who were literate. They were the only ones who could write letters. They were the only ones who could read letter, which meant that the ordinary folk in the place were totally beholden to them, and which possibly could explain the power of the priest in Ireland, certainly at the beginning of the 20th century.
There's a description in this book where it's essential to touch one's cap when in the presence of these authority figures.
Absolutely, yeah. I remember it. The only grandparent we knew was our maternal grandmother, who lived in a small village in Mohill, County Leitrim, which is north of here. We went down to Mohill on our holidays. I'll be talking about the late 50s at this stage. We've been from 6, 7, 8 on. And when the priest walked down the pathway, we were instructed to step off the path and bow as he passed. They were lords. They were the kings. They knew. If they spoke from the church, you might as well leave the area.
How did you feel about doing that?
I was a child. It meant nothing to me.
Do you think that's happening now in Ireland?
No, that's gone. That's long gone. And in a way, in some of it had to happen, and it was happening anyway. But even then, and even growing up in Saltill here in Galway, we had parish priests who were monsters. But you did not speak against the priest. That was law.
Charles McGlinchey doesn't seem to be particularly religious in this book.
No, he doesn't. And it's actually one of the charming aspects of the book, insofar as the Catholicism that Ireland experienced, which emanated from the growth of the middle classes in the 19th century, was not the general Catholicism of the country. There was a vibrant peasant Catholicism underneath that, which had huge mixtures of pagan beliefs.
A lot of the stories that are told in this book involve superstition. Yeah. And there's a section that I'd like to draw your attention to, where Charles McGlinchey is talking about his own ability to read nature in such a way that he can almost magically foretell the future. He writes, "Many of the old people were good at forecasting the weather or noticing a change coming. I wasn't a bad hand at it myself. I would notice signs like the cobwebs on the winds, or a blue blaze in the embers, or the way the smoke goes up from the chimney, or the noise of the water in the brook. After a dry spell, when the brook sounds noisy, the old people would say that the river was laughing for rain."
Yeah, or the way a snail crosses a path, or the way the swallows fly low. They all have stories to tell.
Is this still a part of Ireland today, do you think?
To a degree it is, yeah. You will always get it. I mean, arthritis was a great one. The arthritis is acting up. The rain is coming.
Yeah. Also, many of these superstitions revolved around the animals.
Animals were an important part of their lives. Your wealth was defined by how many cattle you had. Cattle or sheep, not so much horses, although that was in different parts of the country. There is one thing I'd like to read to you, though, if I can find it. The one thing that you can't get, which is not your fault, is the sense of the Gaelic language. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to read 2 poems that are in this, short poems, first in Irish and then in English, if you'll excuse me, right? When my grandfather died, my mother was 16 and the oldest of the family. She was a medium-sized woman and a good carder and spinner. She did the cooking and the sewing and churning and used to be carding or spinning or cloving lint or heckling in the firelight at night. She was not a singer, and I never heard her at any songs, although she belonged to a poor breed there was music in. I heard her tell of a Neurist woman who had her husband and two sons on the sea fishing. This woman had a rhyme, or a prayer, she used to say to the wind. I would say this first in Irish and then in English. Rianas chon de molis atatu. Rianir chon de moiri atame. Riadui is gael ma forch lath. Taranir is torm na fierce lawn lath. O south wind, you are not to my advantage. O west wind, I am not asking you. O north wind, I have a liking for you. Come east and take the men safely home. I think the music in that, if I can get the music, is where this thing lives and balances. When my mother would be sitting patching, I often heard a rhyme. Is far patched in Apol, is far linen all on, is far dinna dunna na gone in dinna, is ni lanach Sinn Féin. A patch is better than a hole, thinness is better than stoutness, a bad person is better than nobody, and that's all that's to it. And in a way, you've got a very simple philosophy of life here.
Yeah.
A very, very simple philosophy of life. And people live by that.
A bad person is better than nobody.
Than nobody. And that's all that's to it. End of story, finished. You know? Annoy is far not at Atlanta, Chenito Fein, Bardach, Rogach, Rachanach. The best remedy for good health, keep yourself well dressed, well shod, and well fed.
Which was rather difficult in Ireland, especially during several famines.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there is talk about the Great Famine of 1845 to 1849, but in some places of the country had famine every year. And it was always known as the, I think it was called the meal months, the 4 months when there were no potatoes, and they were the 4 months where everybody really went hungry. And that happened every year.
Charles McGlinchey lived long enough to see all of his brothers and sisters pass away,
yeah.
His contemporaries also. And in the end, he's sitting down with his friend, Patrick Kavanagh, realizing that his end is near.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love it if we could finish by having you read the final two paragraphs of the book. Yeah.
But my time in this world must be getting short. The people I knew and grew up along with are nearly all gone before me. Over our grave there was always an old quarry flag, but it was getting sunk in the ground with grass growing over it. So 10 or 12 years ago I gave an order for a new one to Owen Roddy. The making of it cost £5, but I was out the best part of £6 to get it erected with the price of drink and all. A pound doesn't go far in drink these times. So whenever I die, they will know where to bury me, and after my day the grave will not be opened again, for I am the last of the name. And when I do go and fall in with Paddy Moore Roddy and the Augustor and Evelyn and Ono Kerrigan and all the rest, sure, I'll be no stranger to them.
Des Kenny, thank you very much for your time.
You're more than welcome.